Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, America, what's going on? I'm Chad Pagano. I'm a former Army sniper, a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and an avid lifelong hunter, and you're listening to The Wild Game Domain, From the Hunt to the Hearth, airing live on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Welcome back. All right, today, I think you're going to find our show somewhat interesting. We are going to talk about, and when I say we, I mean me and Jack, my producer.
Oh, nice. I'm in.
Yeah, you're in. Wait till you hear some of this stuff, Jack. You're going to love it. Because I don't have a co-host anymore. I fired everyone, Jack, by the way. You know, promises.
I'm thrilled to still be here.
No, not you. My co-host. But so it's just me kind of going through a list. I did a little research. I'm going to be honest with you. I knew of some of these, and I think most of you listening have heard of one or two of them, but I don't know if you know the details of what these people go through to get food on the table. You know, we live in a world where, you know, food, anything, hot food really, or any type of food can be delivered to you within minutes, right? I mean, if you have to wait a half hour for the delivery, we're bent out of shape, right? Especially here in Brooklyn, you call a place, it's going to be 40 minutes. You kidding me? Oh, what am I going to do for 40 minutes? So, you know, some of this kind of, you know, you have to really suspend your reality to understand it in ways, you know. Really, where I hunt, I feel like I'm in the middle of the wilderness, well, even when I'm up in the Adirondack Mountains. But the truth of the matter is I could get in my car and within really, you know, at the most 35 minutes, be at a deli or a fast food joint, and I could be stuffing my face full of food. The people we're going to talk about today don't have that advantage or have that luxury in their life. I don't know if it's an advantage, really. We shouldn't be doing that. But they don't have that luxury. So, you know, there are still some places where you can't buy a meal. That's not even a possibility. If you fly there, get off the plane, get in a vehicle of some sort, and get out to these people, your wallet is absolutely useless unless you use your credit cards to chop up the bugs you're going to be eating for dinner that night. So these people, to me, are the badasses. These are the people still existing. These are the people that I won't lie and say I want to live like. But it's part of what I try to experience as a hunter, as a gatherer, as someone who's trying within this modern world to live off the land. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I mean, just the daringness of these people. And I know some of you cynics out there are going to say, what do you mean daringness? You know, it's necessity. They have to live this way. They have to do it. I'm not sure. A lot of you, maybe me, Jack, we might just go and die. We might just say, you know what? I'm not going to eat that. I'm not going to take the chance I have to take to get that food on the table. I'll just go curl up and die. It'll be okay. So, you know, we'll go through it. And we'll get to as many as we can. I have a total of 8, I think. But here we go, starting at the beginning. Honey, the nectar of the gods, right? In Nepal, people actually dangle hundreds of feet off of cliffs to get their hands on this honey. You know, and this is a normal undergoing for the people of Nepal. What goes on here is really a testament to their bravery and you know, their opinion of the reward. They are willing to dangle hundreds of feet off a cliff face, battle really millions of bees for this sweet golden reward. The risk, it's unspoken. You know, I mean, they don't even talk about it. They're that kind of people. They're the kind of people I want to be associated with, you know. Not like me. I was in the Army, you know, I did some stuff, but I like to talk about it. I like to say, hey, wasn't I brave? Look how brave I am. These people just do it as a matter-of-fact way of life every day. But it's understood within these villages in Nepal that these are great men doing great work for the good of their community, their village. And it's experienced, you know, every single year this ritual takes place. And that ritual is they go to these cliffs in Nepal, and the funny thing is that these cliffs are named after the people who have fell to their deaths trying to collect the honey in the past. All of the cliffs are named for the fallen in this ritual. So the gathering is done, you know, by highly coordinated teams, we'll say. These are like the A teams of honey gathering. And these guys are practiced and they know what they're doing and everyone has their job. And they're specialists in their field. And each one in the team is tasked with a specific duty. You know, just like an A team, Special Forces A team. And these guys are recruited, you know, and they're brought in for certain skill sets that they have. So they get to the A team, we'll call them, gets to the cliff. And the first step is, let's, how should we get this started? Let's piss off millions and millions of bees by igniting a huge fire at the base of the cliff. So a couple of the guys on the team get to the bottom of the cliff. They light a huge fire. The smoke's billowing up from the base of this cliff, and it's trying to, first of all, we know smoke relaxes the bees, right? So they're trying to relax the bees a little bit, but they're also trying to drive the bees from the hive. So now, you know, the bees are just swirling around outside the hive, and, you know, they're stinging the hell out of everyone at this point. You know, they're flying down to the source of the fire. They're flying to the top of the cliff to escape the rising smoke. So while the fire is being started and the smoke's starting to come up, the rest of the squad lowers a ladder. And this ladder has, you know, hooks on it, and it's specially adapted, but it's basically a ladder with buckets, ropes, and they lower this down to where the hives are located on the edge of the cliff. And once in place, the team member, and you ready for this? I love this. I should be part of this. I want to experience this one day. The guru, that's the guy who actually gets down there and does the dirty work. So the guru carries two long bamboo poles up the ladder. And basically, he's going to use these sticks to dislodge and to hit the hives of the bee. You know, and there's just an explosion of pissed off bees once he starts doing this. So the guru ties himself to the ladder with one of the ropes and begins to basically blindly, because of all the smoke, smash the poles into the beehives. And he's being given instruction from the guys on top of the cliff and the guys on the bottom of the cliff. They're like, no, go to your right. There's a big hive over there. Look, hit that one. And this guy's performing under all this, you know, stress. He's getting stung. And, of course, he's wearing stuff to try to cover his body, but we know how well that works out. And the goal of the guru is to dislodge, you know, the honeycomb into his buckets, or just to dislodge them so they fall down to the rest of the A-team on the bottom of the cliff so they could be collected. The team at the bottom is responsible for moving the ladder around to reposition the guru. So they got the base of the ladder. The guru's tied to the ladder halfway up the cliff, and they're moving the ladder back and forth to put him in a strategic position to hit these hives. And There's actually a video you could look up on YouTube. It was on, I believe. I looked at a bunch of stuff, and it's really amazing. So this guy is helplessly, you know, dragged across the cliff face. He's getting stabbed in the face by, you know, venomous bees. He's whacking bamboo poles at their hives. And, you know, he's hoping for the best. You know, this whole event usually takes about 4 hours without a break. This guy is hanging from this ladder, battling bees and smoke and honey. You know, and I just, kudos to them. And, you know, and the goal here, gather food. And they end up with a decent amount of beautiful, delicious, golden honey at the end of the day. So that was one. And that was one of the easy ones we're going to get to. That was easy, really. Because in some tribes in Africa, the tribe has decided, hey, you know what? Going out and hunting our own animal is a lot of work, takes a lot of time, and sometimes it's not productive. You know, the amount of time spent trying to take down an antelope just isn't worth it when there's an easier way we could do this. We could just steal the food. We could let something else hunt the food, and then we could steal it. And they wouldn't steal from each other. They wouldn't steal from other tribes, but they will steal from lions, the great hunter of the African plains. So, again, you could imagine the danger of trying to steal food from lions. So, you know, it's the bravado, the guts necessary to do this is just, you know, unbelievable for me. What these guys basically do is they go out in teams, generally three or four guys, and they will find a lion kill. And, you know, it may be half eaten, it's taken down. Sometimes they'll be stalking the lions. They'll find the pride. They'll go and set up and just watch the lions and wait for the lion to take down an animal. Once the lion does, and you got to realize these lions do this in groups. You know, there could be four or five lions that these guys are coming up against. And they'll break from the bushes. And basically what they do, you ready? The men stand straight up tall, shoulder to shoulder. So we got three guys standing shoulder to shoulder. And they just start marching towards the lions. And they're trying to look aggressive. They're trying to look tough. They're trying to look unwavering. And they don't want to falter. And they're taking nice, methodical, they're marching in a nice, methodical manner right towards the lions. And they can't slow or hesitate in any way. If they do, the lion's going to sense weakness, and then they know. But the lions see these three men walking in a business-like manner right towards them, and the lions come to alert. You know, their thing is they have to survive too. So these men don't shout. They don't brandish any weapons. They don't make any obvious threats. But the lions become intimidated. They're like, wait a second, what are these guys up to? These guys have a secret weapon or something? They're just walking up on us? They must have something on us. And the lions will suddenly just stand and take off. They don't want any part of these three strong guys coming across the field. And they'll leave their hard-earned kill. Now, the reality of this is, and, you know, it's that this, what are we going to call it, deception? Won't last very long. You know, the lions are going to get to the wood line and they're going to say, wait a second. I think lions talk to each other once they reach the wood line. And they're like, are you kidding me? We're backing down from these three skinny guys walking across the field? So it doesn't take long for the lions to get back together and say, wait a second, I'm not taking this. So they only have a few minutes here, you know? And then, you know, if they don't get the job done within, you know, 10 minutes, 8 minutes, 5 minutes, you don't really know. You're going to have 15 lions, you know, coming at you from across the field, and they're going to be, you know, three men with some knives in their pockets trying to defend themselves against a pack of really pissed off lions. So they don't spend a lot of time at the kill site. They get in, they take their knives out, they hack off what they need and what they can carry, and what they need to feed their people. Hopefully it's a big kill, could be something really big, and they could get enough meat right there for a week just by running off these lions. Again, it's a hunting technique I don't think I want to be part of in any way. But, you know, the bravery of these men is evident, and the necessity of it is what really strikes me. You know, the fact that they're willing to do it for the good of their tribe. All right, so we got two under the belt. That was pretty good. I got to go a little quicker here. But we're going to take a short break here. You're listening to the Wild Game Domain on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Did you know that pollinators are needed for more than two-thirds of the world's crop species? Most of these pollinators are bees. However, North America's bee population has been steadily declining since the 1990s. Whether you live in the country or the city, you can show your commitment by hosting a hive in your backyard or even on a rooftop. The beekeeping movement is growing, so you're sure to find swarms of folks who can help you find your way. Learn more about the ways you can help be the solution at wholefoodsmarket.com/sharethebuzz.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the Wild Game Domain. I'm your host, Chad Pagano, and we are talking about the bravest, craziest, bizarre ways people actually hunt or gather food in this in the world. Really appropriate commercial that I was cracking up. That was great. Someone should maybe take that organization to Nepal, talk to the guru and explain, hey, guy, I love the way you're doing this, but you could just have a beehive over here. All right. So now we go to Spain, modern country, right? Now we're in Europe. And you know, the beautiful Spanish coast, tourist-friendly coastline, you know, beautiful, picturesque shoreline of Spain. There are men to this day, probably right now, as a matter of fact, risking their life for what they call goose barnacles. And basically, whoever named a goose barnacle never saw a goose, I don't think, because I don't get the name at all. They kind of look like ragged, rustic oysters in some level. They're darker. They're kind of they have a bumpy texture to them. But apparently, these barnacles are a popular delicacy, selling throughout Europe for 200 euros a kilogram. So relatively expensive in the scheme of things. So, you know, in this case, is it survival? No, probably not, really. The incentive here is money, all right? So let's be honest. So you have these professional goose barnacle gatherers who go to the coast of Spain every year to gather these barnacles, and then they make a living. In one season, they'll make a living gathering these barnacles off the shores. And so, again, teamwork is involved here. They work in teams of at least two, and they head down to the rocky coast, and they take turns kind of wandering along or looking or searching along the jagged outcroppings to scrape off bagfuls of these barnacles. And so where's the danger, right? Oh, it seems nice. They're walking along scraping rocks. Seems okay. But basically, they have to climb up a safety line or leaping behind cover as these massive waves come crashing violently down on the shore. You know, we're talking about waves as high as 20, 30 feet. And they have, at best, maybe a minute, and that's at best, between each wave. So this massive 20-foot wave will come blasting into the rocky cropping of the shore with these men, you know, tied off to safety lines, and they'll basically hide behind a rock or an outcropping of rocks and wait for the wave to pass over them and around them. And then they'll get to work, and they have, you know, let's say 45 seconds to start scraping barnacles. So it's frantic. The thing is that these barnacles, the best ones, the biggest ones, they grow towards the lower side of the, at the lower end of the rock, towards the bottom of the rock. And the thing is, to get down to these, they unhook themselves a lot of time. The wave will come crashing in. They'll unhook from their safety line, and they'll almost dive down to the bottom of these rocks. We're talking into deep water, 10, 15 feet of water, and they'll scrape off as many barnacles as they can, quickly returning to the surface, finding their safety line, hooking back into their safety line to ride out the wave that is barreling down upon them. The restaurants in Europe can't get enough of these goose barnacles. You know, they go as far as hiring certain men to do the job for them. The guys who have laid claim to being the best, the guys who have shown in the past they're the best. And these guys make a yearly salary in a couple of weeks' work collecting these barnacles. And many of these collectors, what do we want to call them, gatherers, barnacle gatherers, have died undertaking these the search for these barnacles. So again, I'd rather sit in my tree stand and hunt white-tailed deer. All right, so another one I came across, mussels in northern Canada. So in northern Canada, excuse me, the native tribes up there eat a boatload of seal meat. You know, it's their substance. It's what they live off of. There's really nothing else around for them to eat. I mean, they live off the sea. They live with what they have by the sea. You know, there's obviously not a McDonald's or Burger King. And they basically, you know, live on this, the flesh of a seal for months at a time. And so you could imagine, you know, if I make the same thing twice in a week or give my kids leftovers, there's a riot in my house. They can't eat leftovers. They don't want to eat the same thing twice. So they get motivated to find some other stuff, and that other stuff is mussels. So how hard is it to get mussels? Well, the problem is there's a thick layer of ice that covers the Arctic Sea for most of the year. But the beauty of it is there's still a tide underneath this thick covering of ice. And when the tide recedes, it leaves a cave, a negative space underneath the ice, if you can imagine this, right? So you're on the shore, the Arctic shore, and there's, I don't know, 4 feet of ice, hopefully, give or take. We won't get into global warming and all that business. But, you know, thick layer of ice. They know the tide schedule. Tide goes out, and now there's some space between the ocean floor, the floor of the ocean, and the frozen slab of ice. You know, and so the sea levels up in the Arctic tend to drop really dramatically during the tide. So they could get, you know, 20, 30, 40 feet of space underneath this ice in certain areas along, again, rocky outcroppings. And these seabeds of these beautiful mussels are just exposed for a minimal amount of time for these brave men to basically journey under, you know, unstable sheets, for lack of a better word, sheets of ice, right? And they go into these basically ice caves and start collecting mussels. And they are that serious about having something else to eat. They're like, I can't do it anymore. I'm not eating another seal. I'm going to risk my life under tons of ice for a minimal amount of time before the tide comes in. And I'm going to collect buckets full of mussels before the tide returns. Flooding the cave, pushing the ice back into its place, and trapping these brave men underneath. And that's assuming, you know, just assuming the ice just doesn't collapse on top of them, which they have no idea if it will happen. If it doesn't, it's happened many times. So these guys are actually risking their lives to have some food enjoyment in their lives, to have something other than a seal. And I respect that a lot. We are running out of time quick, so I'm gonna cut to the chase here, because this one, you ready for this one, Jack? Did you eat breakfast?
Yes, I did.
All right, you're not good. Good or bad, I don't know. At this time, I'd like to warn everyone of the graphic nature of the next one, and turn your radios off if you can't stand.
Oh boy.
How certain tribes in Siberia actually castrate reindeer, which is an appropriate topic. You know, I'm a hunter, stupid government trying to castrate my deers out on Long Island, take the herds down. But these nomadic tribes in Siberia have a traditional way to kind of half castrate their male stock of reindeer. And it's for practical reasons. Okay, here we go. I'm just going to say it. You see that delay there? All right. So half castration is when you don't actually remove the testicles, but merely, how do we say, leave them inoperable. And they kind of pulp them up, as we'll say. They kind of puree them in a certain light within the scrotum itself. And it's kind of like, all right, if you have eggs in your house right now, go to your sock drawer, get a sock, okay? Put some eggs in there. If you have time, hard boil them. And then put two eggs in the sock and shorten the sock up a little bit and smash them on your counter a couple of times. That's what we're talking about here, okay? They don't have clinics, they don't have veterinarians to take care of this. You know, the nearest vet is probably, you know, hundreds of miles away. So these people take care of it themselves. So to put it lightly, the reindeer's parts, his magical areas, they don't crush themselves. You could ask, if you're a female, ask a guy if they ever try to crush them themselves. We don't. We try to protect them. So someone's got to do it. Someone's got to do it. And the herders of these reindeer are the ones that got to undertake this. And it's a tradition passed on through families. And you ready for this? You thought it was going to get easier at this point, since I cut to the chase. We're smashing up reindeer testicles. But it doesn't, because here it goes. The traditional way that they do it, you ready? I'm not making this up, is with their teeth.
Ugh.
I know, but there's a reason too. So as you could imagine, biting reindeer testicles is not a job for one person. Reindeer typically, like most living things on the face of this earth, you know what? I'm going to venture all living things on the face of this earth will not let you bite their testicles. So it's at least a two-person job. It would just be ridiculous to try this by yourself. So one person kind of ties up the animal, puts a rope around its neck. The deer is panicking at this point, of course, right? The deer doesn't like having a rope around its neck. And the person's job is to hold the struggling animal down while the other person buries her face in the crotch to chew on the scrotum of the animal, crushing the testicles of the reindeer. So the tradition dictates that the crushing, the chewing of the scrotum and the testicles be done by the women of the tribe. Why this can't be done with a hammer or big rocks is not really clear to me, but it's their tradition. Why males can't do it, I think, is a little silly too. I don't know. Maybe it's tradition. They believe in traditional relationships. So it's got to be a female. I don't know. There was no information on to why they do it with their mouths when I could think of 10 ways to do it. But the point is the castrated reindeer still produce some male hormones. So they don't he'll be less aggressive, but he'll still grow to full size and strength. It won't dwarf the growth of these reindeers. So they're still good for their pelts, their antlers, all you know, their meat, they're still prized. And they're still suitable for pulling their sleds. And the other reason they do it this way, and this is probably why they use their teeth and mouth, maybe it's because they have some control over it. The last thing they want to do in these remote villages is break the skin of the animal. They don't want to cause any infections. They don't want to have the animal have any open wounds. It reduces the risk of an infection. Because again, the nearest vet is hundreds of miles away. And there you have it. And wow. It's all done to produce the best, best, strongest, effective sleigh pulling, antler producing reindeer that these people could get. So, think about that when you're watching Christmas specials this year, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer with the kids and all that business, maybe you'll look at Miss Claus in a different light in some ways. I don't know. Not that I'm judging. I'm not. I'm a libertarian. Do what you want. All right. I think that was a good way to end the wild game domain today. So thank you for listening. It's been a great show. You've been listening to the Wild Game Domain on heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.